Okay, thank you. Agenda paper 12 provides the board with a summary of the comments received on the board's exposure draft, onerous contracts, cost of fulfilling a contract. The exposure draft was published in December last year, and the comment letter period ended on the 15th of April. The exposure draft proposed amendments to IS 37 to specify the cost of fulfilling a contract for the purpose of assessing whether that contract is onerous, comprise the costs that relate directly to the contract. The exposure draft also proposed to provide examples of costs that do and do not relate directly to a contract to provide goods or services. The exposure draft asked stakeholders two questions. The first question is whether respondents agreed that IS 37 should specify the cost of fulfilling a contract comprise the costs that relate directly to that contract. And question two is whether respondents had any comments on the proposed examples. Paragraphs 13 to 21 of our paper summarise the responses to question one. A significant majority of respondents agreed with the board's proposals. However, some respondents either did not agree or did not express an opinion. Paragraphs 22 to 38 of our paper summarise the responses to question two. Respondents generally agreed with providing examples, but many respondents requested clarification about various aspects of the proposals. Other comments raised by respondents are summarised in paragraphs 39 to 58 and Appendix A of our paper. We are not asking the board to make any decisions at this meeting. However, do any board members have any comments or questions on the feedback received on the exposure draft?
Okay, thank you. This is a very good summary of all the feedbacks. Very good. But could you clarify this is paragraph 21 and E? Shared costs, Vodafone's comment.
Yeah.
So Vodafone is suggesting a kind of permission of their maybe some kind of incremental cost approach, because there's some other contract will recover everything of that infrastructure that is shared with this contract. So what is the kind of logic of this kind of idea from Vodafone?
I think they're proposing something that's kind of in the middle of the incremental costs and directly related costs. So I think you'd assess all of your costs if they're shared across several contracts, and if other contracts that Vodafone has entered into cover all the costs related to that shared asset, then the costs related to that shared asset would not be included in one particular only contract assessment.
Our proposal is not consistent with this idea, right?
I think our proposal would be that you would allocate costs of any asset that you're using to fulfil that contract, essentially.
Although there could be a unit of account question that for the likes of Vodafone that must have many, 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 many contracts,
right,
it doesn't seem quite right that they would have to look at each contract individually. Similarly, in the way that IAS2 works on inventories, if we wouldn't necessarily consider every single piece of inventory and write it down to its individual net realisable value. There may be cases for grouping into classes and things. And IAS 37 is not very clear on the point of unit of account. The wording implies individual contracts, but I doubt you could take that to an extreme level anyway.
So what you mean is a manufacturing contracts are a little different from kind of a construction contract, right?
Well, I'm just thinking that in the cases that, if you had a small number of very large contracts that were all quite bespoke and different, it makes sense to look at them individually. But if you had thousands and thousands of customers, I don't know whether there would be a sort of unit of account aspect to it where you could group them to a certain extent.
Anne? I'm just thinking about paragraph 14 and 17 and the feedback that we received. Up in 15, we're told that, 14, we're told that the feedback is that the proposal is consistent with the objective of IAS 37 and consistent with how IAS 37 is applied in practice. And then we move down to 17, where the respondents say the opposite. On balance, do you think what we see here reflects a country practice, particularly for the second thing? You can't... Well, you could say it for the first element, but that would mean that people choose to interpret IAS 37 in a particular way, and their conceptual approach to the meaning of 37 when we think about the particular terms is maybe it's consistent within their one country, so therefore they say it's consistent with 37 or it's inconsistent and this is the dominant practice. So my question is, did any of the feedback try and look across the countries rather than just tell us what their particular country, on balance, the view their country takes?
Yeah, so I think I would agree, first of all, about the country. Obviously, I think there might be some differences within industries in specific countries as well, and then industries across different countries. I'm not sure, in terms of the feedback, some of the respondents in paragraph 17 that disagreed, I think some of them were global organisations, so they may have a wider overview. Again, that may be specific again to their particular kind of experience in applying IAS 37, I'm not sure.
I think as well that probably, and that what you see coming across in some of the comment letters is almost one of the main... reasons that this project came about is that some people have very long held and differing views, completely opposite views of exactly how to read the words in the owner's contract section.
Yes.
So I think probably, you know, so whilst of course that was an important aspect of the ED, that in the basis we explained or tried to explain quite clearly, you know, the board's rationale as to what we were proposing, we didn't see as conflicting with any of the other requirements. I think that potentially that explanation convinced some, but there's some others that weren't necessarily convinced by the explanation.
Sue?
Firstly, Craig, I wanted to say thank you, well done for turning this around with such a good quality paper when the deadline was the 15th of April. It's pretty impressive. Good timeliness. One thing that struck me as I was reading the feedback was the comments that came up in a few different places on this disagreement from some on outcomes you would get if an entity prices contracts sort of consciously only including incremental costs, and how a number of people sort of objected to that. The first time I read it in paragraph 17, I said, sort of, don't be silly, surely that reflects the economics. Just because I've sort of covered my direct cost doesn't mean that I'm whole if I've got other costs in the background. But then because it kept coming up, I stopped and thought a bit. Is it because they're worried that if I had idle capacity and I just did nothing, it would sort of be no sign of it at all, but because I actually made the effort of going and entering into a new contract that only covered the direct cost, suddenly you can see the other costs in the background that otherwise wouldn't be visible? Is that what they're getting at? Sort of,
I think at least one respondent I can remember.
Is that what they're getting at?
I think that's what's underlying it. I also think from the discussions I had with some people, they're thinking of contracts in general, and we might need to do more to emphasise that this all starts to click in only when you have a contract that you would have to pay a penalty if you cancelled it. If you could get out of the contract without paying a penalty, none of this starts to figure in at all. But also, it's got to be quite a long-term contract for it to all to start to become material. If it's just a contract to use current idle capacity where you say, OK, just give me this amount to use up my idle capacity and I'll supply you the goods. If it all happens very quickly, there's nothing to record. It all just happens. And so what we're looking at here is only non-cancellable or cancellable only with a penalty long-term contracts. And so when the company is saying they're utilising idle capacity, they're more than just utilising existing idle capacity. They're locking the business into continuing to use this capacity at below the total cost that they'll have been paying for it, and thereby forgoing the opportunity to use it for a more profitable use as well. Now, in, say, they were doing impairment tests at a very low level, they would have picked that up in an impairment test already. Granted, they might not have if they were doing a big cash-generating unit, but even in these circumstances, I guess that you're giving useful information by saying we have locked the business into a contract at an unsustainable price. If all our contracts were at this price, our business would be unsustainable. So I can see the concerns, but I still think that they're probably, in most circumstances, providing useful information.
It might be one of these tricky situations, which is not unique, where this might actually reflect economics quite well, but because it's not always the case that it's apparent, it shines a spotlight on this.
Indeed. So it's reflecting the economics quite well, but in circumstances where if they hadn't entered into the contract, they wouldn't be reflecting the economics very well.
Gary?
Thank you. Likewise, Craig, I thought it was a very good paper and a very good analysis, and maybe because the inputs was consistent with what I think. I think, you know, the first question is it incremental costs or directly attributable costs? That was the central issue that we've gotten. It was resounding. The majority said it should be one answer. So then a lot of the other questions or comments, as you read them, is really more of how to do it. And particularly people arguing the incremental cost approach is easier to do. There's a lot more cost and effort involved in the directly attributable cost method. So there, I think, at least in my experience, I would probably generally disagree with that. I think, and I'm considering this in the sense of somebody makes tangible goods or sells as opposed to services, but the principles hold on both. Is in, I think in reasonably well-managed companies and very well-managed companies, costs are very well understood. You're not in business long. And particularly in the competitive world, where you're heavy price competition, you can only effectively compete in price competition if you understand the cost to deliver the service. So I think whether it's standard cost versus production variances or fixed or variable or controllable, non-controllable, my point is costs are very well understood. So I think the argument that it'd be difficult to do, you know, and to assign the less incremental and the more but otherwise direct costs, I don't buy it. Now, to do it precisely is a different issue, but to have reasonable and systematic methodology, you know, consistently applied, I think that can be done. And, yeah, there probably is a bit of a range where experts could differ, but I think it'd be close enough, you know, to go forward with the recommendation.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. Just a couple of clarification. Why is, I think, Sue raised the issue about the pricing, because paragraph 17B said that the proposal would not provide useful information, and using the example that the pricing of the idle labor and the machine capacity. I understand maybe the intention behind these comments is that they try to match the cost and the revenue when they sell those machines, something like that. But from pricing perspective, I don't think it's necessary the components of the price should be matched to the components of the cost, because price, it's it really depends on the market condition, customer, something like that. Cost depends on what's the expense, what's the cost they incur. So I'm not sure this is the strong argument to support their comment that it would not provide useful information. And this is the reality, this is the economic reality we should reflect. So, and in another thing that I'm thinking about, actually, it's really needed to clarify what's the economic benefit. There's some connection there. So so this is relevant to the paragraphs 18, and also we talk about the project provision. We do need to clarify what's the meaning of the economic benefit the entity are going to receive. And secondly, with regard to paragraphs 17C, and mentioned about inconsistent between, there's some conflict with other requirements in ICE 37. There are some examples, but there are no detailed analysis. I think we should analysis further. If there are really some inconsistent there, I think we should propose whether any amendment should have, or even through this project, or even through the provision project, to reduce those conflict. And the third is, thirdly, about paragraph 20. The Korea Accounting Standards Board raised some issues. I'm not very much clear what's the issue it is. It said that in their experience, some manufacturing entities typically increase only incremental costs when assessing whether a contract is onerous. What kind of contract? And why, in this case, especially for manufacturing entities, they only include the increment costs. Other entities may include the other costs. So I'm not sure what's the issue exactly it is, and what's the contract it refers. It's about the selling cost or you know, producing something with what kind of contract it refers to.
So I was particularly questioning that as well, because I would have thought that manufacturers of any group would be quite capable of measuring the other costs, because they do so to measure their inventory and work in progress.
Yes.
And all we're really asking them to do is to use the same costs
for
measuring their future, effectively the inventory they haven't yet built, mm-hmm. as the ones that they have built. So, yeah. But we should look into that.
I think it's a good point, because I think that there isn't more detail in the comment letter about the types of contracts here, but I think it's one that will be worth following up with the respondent to find out more.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
And just to comment again on your point about in 17C, I think that was certainly analysed in the exposure draft, but certainly when we bring back a decision-making paper, we can, you know, reanalyse, re-look at any comments that we get about possible conflicts within IS 37.
Okay. And finally, about, I think EY raised a point with in the paragraph 26. They would like to the explanation, what's the meaning of the directly related cost, include what kind of cost. We include those elements in the basis on conclusion. And it says whether it could be included in the standard itself. I think it's a very good point to make it clear what's the meaning of the directly related cost included. So I support this kind of suggestion.
Tom.
Yeah, just I think something Joan said, Twig, was typically when you think about incremental costs, you're actually looking at a very short time horizon to really call them incremental. I mean, there's been a ton of work done that shows in the long run, all costs are variable and incremental, and so the idea of incremental is very time-linked, and we're talking about contracts that run at least across the end of the period, right? And so as you get longer, the direct costs become the incremental costs, and I think fairly quickly. So I think on balance, if what we want to do is eliminate the diversity in practice and we're dealing with longer-term contracts, then for a properly executed thing, I think the direct costs would be typically pretty close to incremental. And so I think we've probably got it right.
Martin.
And maybe a stupid question, but an example, if you are a landlord and renting out flats, and let's assume you have maybe 10 flats and 9 are already rented out and your direct cost already covered by this 9, but you have one flat is empty, and then you're making a contract and renting that also out and saying, but only for incremental cost because your direct cost already covered by that, would that be an onerous contract then and you have to take a loss? And if that is true, I think we have to look really at the benefits, which some people suggested. In isolation, doing that is difficult, and also in isolation of one contract, maybe you have to look at the group of contracts, but also I think you have to look at the benefits. Because man, if you have this kind of property in my example, which is 9 flats and one is not rented out, you don't have any loss because you don't have a contract. But if you're then renting it out only for incremental costs, and is not covering if you allocate direct costs with that flat, then you have to book suddenly a loss, I think, which would not be appropriate. And therefore, why is that? Because you're not looking at on the benefits overall, you're looking at the individual contract. Maybe I was not clear, but I thought about that kind of things, and that is what I thought, what people maybe have said in paragraph 21.z with the pricing, because sometimes it would make a lot of sense to have the pricing only on incremental costs, maybe to get something subleased or whatever kind of stuff, which is beneficial and I think would be a good thing. And if you don't doing that, you don't have any loss, but if you're doing that, then by doing this kind of accounting, then you're coming up with an onerous contract, which I find it difficult. Maybe that is stupid, but I think about this example. What I
I wonder whether in that case, but I mean, it's an example that we can think through as we go through. I mean, I wonder whether in that case you may not necessarily get to a different answer via onerous contract route versus impairment of assets, because in the case of rental, well, maybe if it's different floors or something, because when you're thinking about maybe
my example
for
was
rental,
the cost,
you know, the cash generating
unit. By the 9 rentals already done, so you don't have an impairment of the building. But think about.
I think you're thinking about 9 floor, you know, within one unit, yes. So you're right, it probably is one cash generating unit. I was thinking if it was, you know, potentially a separate property, it might be its own cash generating.
My point was only that some people think they're pricing it on incremental cost. I think even if they're doing this, they can still, on the overall thinking, a positive thing. But then if by isolation of individual contracts, then we're coming up with an onerous contract.
Mary?
It's overkill, but I want to echo yet again the compliments for a timely and well-done paper. It's hard to do, and you did it well. One thing that struck me looking at paragraph 17 of the paper, we have some people saying that incremental approach is established practice under 37. But if I go back, I went digging around in old versions of the bound volume and came up with the IS 11 criteria that were, you know, that were there and used before 2018. And they line up, map very closely to what we have in the ED. So I think what this is saying is there are some people who are looking only at IS 37, and part of the reason why practice diverged, or practice is now going to diverge, is that they're the old IS 37ers, who some of whom say incremental is the established practice, and there are the old IS 11ers who had guidance that's very much aligned with what we're proposing, because 11 required allocation of costs. So at least understanding why it's an issue is, I think, something we should acknowledge. But I think it is a practice issue that's come to head, and I would be minded to go ahead and resolve this aspect of diversity in practice based on what we've learned. As I look at paragraph 17, kind of work up from the bottom, I think, as Petrina, you said this earlier, we have considered the arguments raised in paragraph 17C, and we're comfortable that we're not in conflict. When I look at 17B, and this is kind of the example that Martin raised. Okay, maybe in that circumstance, pricing on an incremental basis might make sense for the owner or landlord of that building. But I kind of feel like if we go this, it depends on how you price, we'll get entities doubling down on bad decisions. So if you decide to price in a long term on an incremental basis, and then we say, well, then test your impairment that way, you won't, you will defer recognition of impairment, owner's contracts longer. And while impairment might pick up some of it, I think we should have an approach that is not subject to what your model or thinking in the pricing of your contracts is. It's more an absolute, is this contract onerous? And so I think we have to think about the change management issues in A, and or the cost of change versus the benefits of comparability. And then some, I think, second-order issues. A couple people questioned why it was pension costs rather than employee benefits. I think we should think about that. I agree with the original proposal, and while it would be attractive to address benefits, I think that's opening a much bigger can of worms, and this is meant to be a narrow scope project. I did think it was interesting to see the encouragement to think about alignment with IS2 and the cost of inventory, and that's something I'd ask the staff to bring us back in their further analysis. I'm not saying I want to go that way, but I just want to make sure we've thought about that and whether we're creating some breakage that doesn't make sense. But thought it very helpful, and I think we just have to try and figure out why 17A is there, and as I said, that's my guess about it, but I think that 17B, we do get useful information even if the entity prices on an incremental basis.
When I was thinking about paragraph 20 in the Korean Accounting Standards Board feedback, it made me wonder if where entities are more likely to have onerous contract when direct costing is used rather than using incremental costs. So if an entity is using incremental costs, are they less likely to get an onerous contract and therefore the amounts of onerous contracts are less? And was that something that you could observe in any way that aligned with the sort of feedback that you got?
I'm not sure that it would.
So in principle, you were nodding. So in principle,
it's a direct consequence. So one set of costs is bigger than the other set of costs, so you will get more and bigger provisions. Yeah. So
Okay. So given that in principle, could you see any relationship with the answers we got that people would say, well, this is how we read it and this is what the underlying concept should be? Can you see any relationship with that, with the idea that what we just said about you're more likely to get onerous contracts when you used the direct costs are included? Can you see any relationship between the feedback and the economic outcome?
Companies in the countries that said incremental costs is more prevalent compared to the countries that said direct costs are more prevalent, comparing the size of their onerous contracts.
Yeah, just, has that come through in any way?
It's not something I don't think I've looked at.
To get reliable information without doing proper research. You could only infer that perhaps that might influence the feedback.
Yes, but we don't have, at this stage, we don't have evidence of that. That hasn't come through in anything we've been collecting.
Not reliably enough.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Diversity in practice about incremental or allocation of costs. I think it largely depends on the industry basis or a type of contract. For the industry like construction industry, so they used to use IS 11, so they normally allocate costs. But when you look at the service company who are providing services with a fixed capacity, with a fixed numbers of employees, then the more you can get the contract, you can earn more cash. So eventually, if you get the additional contract, then you could recognize smaller incremental costs, and then they welcome those new contracts. Mm-hmm. However, once we put this standard proposal, then for those entities, the new contract could be onerous. And like Martin's example, it may change their behavior significantly. So therefore, we must be very careful about this proposal. And then if the divergence came from the industry basis or type of contract basis, we need to make the scope narrower than the just the IS-37, because IS-37 covers all the contract. So therefore, those who are doing incremental costs would raise the significant voice. But we have to come back why it came about. The problem was IS-11, and IFRS 15 didn't inherit IS-11. And the contract like IS-11 covers really much with this cost allocation. So I think I would suggest in order to make it successful and to make it quite in a timely basis, I think we have to narrow down the scope just for the IS-11 type of contracts.
Gary?
Yeah. Very quickly, something that struck me as Ann raised the Korean Accounting Standards Board, and I think Tak pointed out it as well. It, to some extent, does depend on industry, but anybody, certainly Korea was talking about a manufacturing environment, but anybody who uses a standard cost system, you think direct labor, direct materials, yes, that's probably very much incremental. When you go to overhead in your standard costing, I can assure you most overhead in standard cost environments, it's got lots of fixed and central costs that are not, as somebody had said, yes, they're variable in the long run, but they're not variable in the short run. You're just charging out fixed costs. And so I would argue in some instances, when we're having a theoretical debate of incremental versus direct, it actually might be a lot closer than you think you are.
Okay. Thank you very much.